journey on. Magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses and therefore themselves and everyone around them through his transformational training program. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see what it
shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller and I have a special guest this week. You know, I had several people reach out to me and ask me, could I get him on the podcast? And then I was presenting at Equine Affair in Columbus, Ohio, probably 6 weeks ago now. And I met the guy there, and what an amazing dude this guy is. So his name is Felipe Massetti Leite, and he is a Brazilian guy. And he's written a book called Long Ride Home, and it is the story of him riding from Calgary, Alberta, to Barretos, Brazil. So he rode from Alberta, Canada, through the US, through Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, etc., etc., all the way down to Brazil. I'm going to read, and he's written a book, and there's also a major motion picture coming out about it. The book's called Long Ride Home, and I'll read you the little blurb from the back of it. It says, "How far would you go for your dreams? This is the story of a Brazilian student who rode 10,000 miles from Canada through the Americas to his home in Brazil. 2 years, 3 magnificent horses, 10 countries, and 1,000 stories of drug cartels, mass migration, the glorious wilderness, the old cowboy ways, the kindness of strangers, and the powerful connection between man and beast. This is a tale of grit and inspiration of Felipe and Frenchie, bruiser and dude chasing a dream, one hoof at a time." Yeah, so he documented the whole thing. They filmed the whole thing, and he's now going to be a documentary film that's doing the rounds of all the film festivals. So that was his first ride. So it's from from Calgary to Brazil. Then later on, he took on another journey. He rode from Brazil to the bottom of Argentina. And then at some point in time, he did another journey where he rode from Fairbanks, Alaska, back down to Calgary. And so he's basically ridden from Fairbanks, Alaska, so the kind of top of Alaska, to the bottom of South America on a horse. And I think he mentions on the podcast, but he says, you know, there's been 11 or 12 men who've walked on the moon. There's only been 5 men who've ridden from the Fairbanks, Alaska, to the bottom of Argentina, and he is one. So this guy is such an amazing, you know, such an amazing human, and it's such an amazing story. So I can't wait for you to listen to this episode with Felipe Massetti Leite. Felipe, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be able to tell my story.
Oh, I've been so excited to have you share your story because, you know, when we met there in Columbus, Ohio, we went out to dinner with your lovely wife, Clara, and yeah, the stories you told me were absolutely amazing, and I'm not even sure where to start, but let's do the bit of a recap here. You rode from Calgary, Alberta to Brazil, is that correct?
That is correct. That was my first journey. It was 803 days in the saddle across 12 nations, and once I got to Brazil, I continued on to the southern tip of Argentina, a small town called Ushuaia. And then when I got there, I decided to go my last long ride, which was from Alaska back to Calgary. I am today the youngest person to have ridden the Americas in its entirety on horseback.
Holy cow, that's amazing. So I know quite a bit of these stories, but why don't you tell us what inspired you to think about doing this in the first place?
So it all started with a book, you know, the importance and the power of literature. When I was a little kid, I was the most scared kid on the planet. And every time my dad turned the light off in my room, I, you know, was afraid that the boogeyman was under the bed, behind the closet, and I would cry. And my dad would come into my room, and at that moment, he would teach me one of the most important lessons of my life, which is that fear doesn't exist. Fear is a monster that inhabits our minds. And he would say, if we don't put that monster aside, you can't do anything with your life. And to kind of show me that, he would tell me the story of Aim Chifley, a Swiss school teacher who in 1925 rode two Criollo horses from Argentina all the way to New York City. And he would say, listen, Chifley wasn't scared. You know, he climbed the Andes. He crossed these rivers full of crocodiles. He crossed Central America on the back of a horse. And he would read me a part of that book. And for some reason, I don't know why, it became my life's dream to one day go on my own long ride.
So that was as a kid. And then, so you ended up, so was that in Brazil? Because you moved from Brazil to Canada when you were younger. Was that, were you still in Brazil then?
Yes, sir. Yeah. So I was born in the interior of São Paulo, 2 hours from the actual city of São Paulo, and had an amazing upbringing there. My dad, you know, loves horses. So he used to ride Bronx and cut and rope. And I lived in Brazil until I was 9, and then my parents ended up moving to Canada.
Did you speak in English when you went to Canada?
No, I did not. I went on like an intensive 1 month English course before I came, and I learned things like cat and ball and where's the bathroom, but didn't know a lick of English other than that.
Well, and how was that moving to nine years old, moving to another country and not speaking the language? How was that?
You know, at the time it sucked. Like, I remember when my parents told me we're moving to Canada, I was like, I don't know what Canada was. And then my first day of school, I was so scared, you know, it felt like those kids are going to eat me apart. I just looked completely different from everyone. Like I said, I didn't speak English. I was going to school in a portable with like little chairs with tennis balls at the bottom of them, like just completely different from anything I'd ever known in South America and Brazil. But, you know, it's ultimately a moment that made me who I am today. You know, it was one of the first times that I faced real adversity. I remember just crying outside of that school, and when my dad was, you know, telling me it's going to be okay, you're going to be fine. And then by the end of the first recess, I had made my first friend already, you know, and I realized that the kids weren't monsters, and that, you know, with a little bit of soccer and playing with these kids, it was going to be okay. But again, it was the first moment where I realized that, you know, I could get through these tough moments in my life.
Well, that was a great start to a lot of tough moments. So you ended up going to university up there, getting a degree in journalism. What attracted you to the journalism?
So I've always loved storytelling, you know, like I said, my dad used to read me that book when I was a little kid. I've always loved movies and documentaries and books and the power that these stories have, you know, to create a more just world, to inspire. And from a very early age, I started writing. Before I even got into university, I had, you know, a bunch of articles that were already printed. I loved taking photographs, and it was just very natural to me to pursue journalism.
Okay. So let's get to your trip here, because it was I've got the books here. I haven't read the books yet, because I didn't want to know all the stories, because I've heard you on another podcast and I've got quite a few of the stories. So how did you prepare for, what sort of preparation did you do for that initial journey, that initial, what is it, 10,000 miles?
Yes, sir. So I spent 2 years. The first thing I did was create a war room and just began planning this beast. It was, you know, 10 countries. It was 10,000 miles. It was 2 years. It was really hard. So I always say strategic planning, for most people, it's a difference between success and failure. For me and for long riding, it's life and death, not only for yourself, but your animals. So the first thing I needed to do was learn how to travel on horseback. I used to tie down rope. I grew up rodeoing, but it's completely different for you to, you know, grab a horse from a stall and ride it for a couple hours, train and put it back, and then get on a horse and ride it for 8 to 10 hours a day in the middle of nowhere. So I really had to speak to long riders around the globe. I had to read as much literature as I could. And I also went to Sten Walchuk. He's a legendary Canadian long rider. I went to his wilderness riding clinic to learn how to, you know, pack horses, how to tie hitches, how to weigh your pack saddle and your panniers and how to highline horses and camp with them in the middle of nowhere. So learning abundance from him. The other part of the planning was getting my body ready, losing as much weight as possible, building my core. And finally, it was drawing the route and also finding the financing to actually undertake this journey.
You know, that little sentence, that long sentence you said right then, there was so much to that. You went to the wilderness training camp thing. You know, lost a lot of weight. You worked on your core. Tell me, let's break that down a little bit, because I don't know, you know, I haven't heard any of this stuff here. So how long was the wilderness training camp thing?
So the wilderness training clinic was 2 weeks out in northern BC, McBride, BC. And it really allowed me to actually test everything that I learned, you know, not only speaking to these long riders. I spoke to Pedro Luiz de Aguiar, a legendary Brazilian long rider, Cacolin O'Reilly, who now lives in France and rode through Pakistan, Bernice Andy, who's American and has ridden thousands of miles across the United States, Gunter, a German. So all of these long riders gave me skills and tricks that, you know, I was writing down, I was reading about, I was seeing in videos. But then when I actually got to stands, it was like, you know, I was actually tying that hitch. I was actually throwing that pack on the back of the horse. And those 2 weeks were detrimental to my success.
How many people were at this? Was this like a one-on-one thing, or was there a bunch of people there at this thing?
No, there was about five people there at the clinic. And it's really cool because Stan used to be a teacher back in the day, and he's done his own long ride from northern British Columbia to Alaska. And so he's not only a guy that has done it, but he's able to teach it really well. He's developed this textbook. So you do in-class learning in the morning, and then in the afternoons, you go out on the trail with the horses, and then you do a longer pack trip through the northern Rocky Mountains. So again, I can't thank Stan enough for all of the skills that he passed on to me.
Wow. And then so let's talk about the losing weight and getting your core right. What did you do there?
So, you know, that's one of the first things I learned, especially speaking to Bernice Andy. We lost her last year, unfortunately, but she was an amazing long rider, and she used to be a ballet teacher. So she's very, you know, strict and stern. And the first time I met her, she's like, kid, if you're expecting your horses to carry you all this distance, you got to lose as much weight as you can. And she really instilled that in me. And it makes sense. You know, have you ever seen an overweight jockey? Like, you know, if we're asking these animals to carry us, I think that the least that we can do when you're out there for 8 to 10 hours a day is be as light as possible. You know, long riding, it's all about, you know, having light gear. Your pack saddle needs to be as light as possible. Your riding saddle. I actually developed a saddle using the tree of a barrel saddle. So it's super light. It has the seat of a reiner. But yeah, I lost weight. I worked on my core. I knew I was going to lose a lot of muscle out there when I was on the journey itself, because you're not able to hit the gym. You know, you're on your horse for a long time every day. I tried to walk as much as possible as well to help the animals, but the gym also helped a lot with pushing yourself mentally. You know, sometimes when I was doing reps and you feel like your arms can't, you know, lift anymore, and I would start naming out countries, you know, like Guatemala, Honduras, and I feel that was preparation not only physically but mentally as well.
Oh, that's cool. Hey, you keep mentioning the term long rider, and I know there's a long riders guild because you told me that before when we were at dinner, but what constitutes a long rider? And like, how far do you have to ride to say I'm a long rider?
So a long rider is someone that rides more than 1,000 miles consecutively in a single journey. And okay. Yeah, it's a long ways. And famous long riders are Marco Polo, Charles Darwin, Aim Chifley, the Swiss school teacher who inspired me. And there's still people to this day jumping into the saddle and riding off into the unknown.
Wow. 1,000 miles consecutively?
Yep.
So people who've done the Mongol Derby are not long riders because that's 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, it's about 1,800 kilometers constitutes 1,000 miles.
All right. Wowzers. That's cool. So you had this big war room set up. So you're planning your route. How much, because I know you knocked on a lot of doors and said, hey, can I put my horses up for the night? How much planning did you have as far as where you're going to stay, or did you just ad lib that whole thing the whole way?
Yeah, definitely. That was all like the first day when I left Calgary, July 8th of 2012. I was so scared. I didn't know how the hell I was going to survive all this. I felt like I had a bowling ball lodged in my throat, and I had no idea where I was going to sleep that night. And I rode about 20 miles that first day and knocked on some, you know, stranger's door. And that was the reality of most of the journey. You just literally, first you try to find a house or a ranch or a farm. If there is, you knock on the door and ask for help. If there isn't, you look for a place where you can highline your horses and hopefully find some water and some grazing ground. And then you get up the next day and continue on. When I was planning, the important thing about drawing the route is knowing what you're going to get yourself into, you know, from the social economic situation of these countries, you know, like in Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, these countries are in war due to the drug traffic. So I had to know that. I had to plan for that. Geography, you know, am I going to be crossing deserts? Is it mountainous? What kind of riding will I be doing? Is it through cities? So I drew out an actual route before I left using physical maps and Google Maps. But then once you actually start the journey, it's the people that end up guiding you, you know, because you'll know the best 20-mile route for me to take from your ranch to the next place. You might know someone down the road that you're going to call up and they're going to take me in. So the local people end up drawing your route.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So tell us about your first day, because that's like the slap in the face, like, you know, that first 20 miles. How was that?
Oh, that was terrible. Like, it was just so, I was like, what did I get myself into? I had to do everything, you know, like I was leaving from the Calgary Stampede, the largest rodeo in Canada, you know, the media were there filming me. There was media outlets from Brazil, from Canada, from the US. So I not only had to be the long rider, I had to be the publicist. I was filming everything. So I had to be the journalist. I documented everything for a production company out of Nashville. And when I get about 5 miles out of Calgary, I realized that all my water is tied up in the pack saddle. I'm like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. It's like 100 degrees, mid-July in Canada. I'm like, if I have no water and I'm just leaving, how am I going to survive Mexico? So, and then, you know, by the end of the day, that feeling of not wanting to ask for help, you know, it's so not normal for us, you know, today to knock on someone's door and ask for help, especially when you have like two horses with you. And I was just so embarrassed. And it was, I'd really fight myself internally. The first house I went to, there was no one there. I'm like, oh my God, I had worked up all this courage for an hour, you know, talking to myself. And then all of a sudden it's like, wah, 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 no one's home. Then I had to work myself up again and go to the next house. But luckily, you know, this journey, one of the biggest lessons I've learned is how kind humanity is, how amazing our fellow humans are. And, you know, that first family took me in, and then the rest was history. That second day got a little easier and we continued south.
Did you average about 20 miles a day? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, that's about what you do. That's another lesson I learned from these long riders is 20 miles is a sweet spot, not only for the horses, but for the rider as well. And you ride about 3 to 4 days, rest two, ride five, rest three. You really have to go your horse's pace here, and everything has to slow down. What you usually do in a car in an hour is going to take you a week. And that's just the name of the game when you're long riding.
So tell me that again. What did you say? Ride three, rest two?
Yep. Ride three, rest two. Ride five, rest three. You rest a lot. Like, people don't realize that. They think that you're just going to get on a horse and ride continuously till you finish. But and you know horses, right? They fawn there. There's things that happen. And you got to just, if they're hurt, you got to wait, stop, wait till they're better. Because without your horse, you're not riding a single kilometer. So you always got to be watching out. If they begin to think about losing weight, you stop, you find alfalfa, you find grain, you fatten them up before you continue.
And you rode one and led one, is that right?
I started with two quarter horses that were donated for the journey, both from Montana, and I would ride one and the second would take the pack saddle. And then when I got to the southern part of the U.S., I was given a Mustang. And then I had three horses for the rest of the way to Brazil, which helped tremendously because I was able to alternate. One horse always walked with nothing on its back, and then one would have me on, and then the other one would have the pack. So that really helped. It was hard at times because, you know, it's another animal to feed. It's another animal to find water. sometimes I'd be next to roads. So now we have three horses. If the ditch is tight, that became, you know, really dangerous, but it helped with the riding.
I bet. So let's talk about, okay. So you had said that, and you told me when we went to dinner that time that you approached different people to different media companies to help fund this thing. And so you filmed the whole thing. Tell me about the filmmaking process. As far as, did you just do it on a phone? Did you have a GoPro? What sort of cameras did you use?
Yeah, so that I figured early on, because I didn't have any money to actually go on the ride, is that I was going to have to find a way to pay for this. You know, this is my dream. But so I reached out to hundreds of production companies around the world. And, you know, they were all like, oh, it's too long. It's impossible. You're going to die. You're never going to be able to do this. Until finally, a production company out of Nashville bought the project for me to film it. And they gave me all the equipment as well. So I had two Canon cameras. I had two GoPros. I had my phone as well. And the cameras would shoot with two cards, A and B. So once a month, I would FedEx the footage to them. And I would FedEx cards A and key B, just in case we didn't lose anything. And then once they told me, oh, it's backed up on our computers, I would be able to film with the other cards.
And so they've now made a movie about this, and you've been taking it around the film festivals. How's that going?
Oh, it's going so well. You know, it was a dream come true. Like when I started filming this 10 years ago, you know, like I said, no one believed in it. Like it was like, no one's going to want to watch this. It's going to be too long. You're going to die anyways. You're never going to make it. And so our first film festival was the Beaufort International Film Festival. And when I got to see that film with an audience and see their reaction, you know, people were crying, people were laughing. We got a standing ovation at the end. We ended up winning the audience award for best film of the festival. It was just like, you know, it's one of those moments in your life where you'll never forget it. Like I remember being a 20-some-year-old kid working two jobs and planning this thing and pressing the record button and saying, I'm going to ride a horse from Canada to Brazil. And then there I was watching it. And just take the opportunity while we're on here. I know you have so many listeners all over the U.S. We got into one of the best festivals in Hollywood. It's called Dances with Films. We're going to be there June 16th at the iconic Chinese theaters in Hollywood.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm just so excited. I want to invite you as well. 7 p.m. June 16th. Hollywood, baby, the long rider. I'm just over the moon about it. And I'm hoping to find a horse to arrive on horseback. And yeah, I'm so excited.
Oh, if you need help finding a horse in California, I can help you out.
Done. Let's talk about this after.
Okay, we will. That's cool. I'll have to, I want to stop the podcast and go and ask Robin, hey, what are we doing on June 16th?
Oh, well, I hope you're around. It would be I'd love for you to be there.
That'd be super fun. And what other film festivals have you had it at?
So we just came back from Edmonton this weekend. That was an awesome. It's Canada's longest running documentary festival. We went to Sunscreen in Florida, won the best documentary award there. We'll be heading to Mumbai, India now. We have Wyoming, Brazil. We have one in Washington State. We've had a really amazing reaction to the film. You know, you apply to these festivals, and just to get in is already a tremendous honor, because they're getting like thousands of films, and you know, and we're actually winning awards. And again, this is just a tiny film. Like, this is a guy, everyone always asks at the end, who filmed the documentary? I filmed it. I'm the director of photography. So you can imagine how tough it was, you know, when horses are falling into holes, or when bullets are flying around me, when I'm in the desert, I'm not only having to keep my animals and myself alive, I'm also having to take out the camera and film everything. So, you know, to be competing against these, you know, million-dollar productions with like a 30-person crew and just little Felipe out there, and to be able to be taking awards home is tremendous. And I got to thank our director, Sean Cisterna, here from Canada, NC2 Media, the production company that believed in me from the beginning, Mythic Productions, and everyone involved with the film. It's been tremendous.
When is it going to be released, like, publicly?
So it'll be released in the end of the year. We sold it in Canada to Super Channel and Amazon Prime, And now after we go through the festival run, we'll sell the global rights. So it'll come out in one of the streaming services by the end of 2022. It's called The Long Rider.
So it's going to go straight to streaming services. It's not going to be in theaters.
It will also be in theaters. It will be in theaters here in Canada this summer, and in the US probably around September. So I'll announce that.
So cool. Hopefully I'd love to see it in the big screen. Hopefully I get to see it in the Chinese theater in July, but on June, sorry. I just got to figure out where I'm going to be, because I never know where I'm going to be. I'm all over the place. So you just mentioned something funny a minute ago, like, yeah, you know, when horses are, you know, I've got to try to do all the filming when a horse is stepping in a hole and the bullets are flying, and you just kind of grazed over that, like, oh, yeah, when the bullets are flying. Oh, another thing you said, oh, it's going to be in Mumbai, India. Are you going to India for the festival?
You know, I'm not sure yet. We're trying to figure out scheduling, because I have to go back to Brazil to do some motivational speaking. And I'm trying to figure out if I can go from Sao Paulo straight there. But I really hope so. I've never been to India, and I love to travel. I'm very obviously, you know, there's some nomadic gene in my system. So yeah, I would absolutely love to go to India. Have you ever been?
No, India's on my bucket list. Like, it's a place I really want to go and go and visit. So let's get back to your journey here, because I want to hear some of the stories about things that happened along the way. And I wonder if you can relate the story about the ashes. I just thought that was amazing.
Yeah, it's always the one that hits home to people, especially in the documentary. Like, it's crazy, you know. So I get to this guy's house in Craig, Colorado. I'm pretty early on in the journey still in the northern U.S. And his name is Peter Lisker. And like so many, you know, I've met hundreds, if not thousands of people that took me in. I rode more than 25,000 kilometers from Alaska to Ushuaia, and 30 kilometers a day. So you can imagine how many homes I went into. And this guy, at the end of my stay there, he was kind of acting weird. And I'm like, oh my God, did I do something? You know, you're always like blaming yourself. Was I rude? Did I say something wrong? And he goes, Felipe, I'm going to ask you something, and feel free to say no. But I really believe in the universe. I believe in destiny. And I'm not sure why you ended up on my doorstep. You know, you could have asked for help three doors down or three ranches up, but I feel like God brought you to my doorstep. I would like to ask you to take my sister with you on this journey. And I'm like so confused. And I look at him and he says, my sister Naomi passed away just a few months ago. And she loved horses. She was an adventurer. And I feel like, you know, the universe, God brought you to my doorstep to take Naomi on one last ride. And I also, you know, I'm a big believer in faith. And I was like, oh my God, for sure. So he gives me the ashes and I take it with me. And a month goes by and I get really tired to a place called Cuba, New Mexico. And I ended up putting the panniers, the boxes from the pack saddle, in with the horses. I was like, I'll take it out tomorrow. I'm so tired. So I put them in a corral, put the boxes in, and wake up at 6 a.m. when I unzip my tent and look out. Frenchie, one of the quarter horses I was riding, who was like just like a kid. He just did things that he shouldn't be doing at all times. He had knocked over the panniers. The ashes had spilled out, and now he was eating Naomi's ashes. And I'm like, oh my God. So I jump over the fence, get Frenchie off the ashes, say a Hail Mary, apologize to Naomi. Well, Frenchie got hit by a truck in southern Mexico. And as you know, as you know, the horse folks listening to this podcast know, when a horse is hit by a vehicle, it either dies right away or you have to put it down, you know. And Frenchie survived miraculously. And there were so many moments on this journey where I thought I was going to die, or I thought I was going to lose one of my animals. And somehow, some way, the universe conspired in our favor and we came out alive on the other side, that I started to believe that it wasn't destiny to take Naomi on one last ride, but have her come with me as a guardian angel. And I felt her presence throughout this entire journey and her protection. And when I got to Brazil, I still had the ashes with me, and I poured it into my hand and thanked her and prayed for her. And in the pasture where I retired my kids, Frenchie, Bruiser, and Dude, I spread her ashes and asked for her to continue protecting these animals for the rest of eternity.
Wow. You know, I thought that, because I've heard the story before, I thought it wouldn't affect me like it did the first time. But yeah, that was just as good the second time as it was the first time. So tell us the states you went through. So you from Alberta, you crossed into Montana, did you?
Yeah, Montana. I'm blessed, you know, work, because I love the United States. And as a cowboy, you know, I don't know if you can relate to this because you're also not from the U.S., but, you know, I'm from Brazil. So cowboys come from America, right? And I used to watch all the old Westerns with my dad, and I watched Cheyenne, and I watched, you know, all these huge rodeos. And for me to cross that region where I crossed was just a dream come true. I went into Montana, Glacier National Park. And then from Montana, I crossed into Yellowstone National Park, went into Wyoming, came out in Cody, Wyoming, where they have a rodeo every day in the summer. I almost didn't leave there because a cowboy from Texas lent me his roping horse. So I was tied down roping every night. Then from Wyoming, I crossed into Colorado into New Mexico, Texas. And then from Texas into the Chihuahua Desert.
Into the Chihuahua Desert in Mexico. So how was it crossing the border? Because you had some interesting border crossings. I know you told me that.
I hate borders. I hate borders. You know, these imaginary lines drawn by men long ago. Just nonsensical. And I have a story with immigration. Like, my parents came to Canada when I was 9 years old, as I said at the beginning of this podcast. My dad had a work permit. And after 10 years, that work permit got denied. And my dad hired a lawyer and got some bad advice and ended up applying for humanitarian reasons from within Canada. That took 2 years, in which it got denied again. And we got 15 days to leave the country. You know, I had a horse. I had a life here. I never imagined. There was never my plans to go back to Brazil. And we had to pack up all our things and go back to Brazil. So that's one of the themes of the documentary. You know, we talk about immigration and borders and yeah, like that first border, the Canada to the U.S. was super easy. You have all your papers in order, you're in. But then from U.S. to get into Mexico, it took weeks. A foreigner can only import 2 horses into Canada. So my Mustang dude had to be ridden illegally over the Rio Grande.
You mean into Mexico?
Into Mexico, yes, oh, sir. Yeah. And yeah, it was just a bureaucratic nightmare. And then after that, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse every border I got into.
You know, it's funny you're talking about Canadian immigration. I've had some trouble at the border there. I was presenting at a horse expo, and I can't remember if it was the one in Red Deer, Alberta, or it was Chilliwack, British Columbia, one or the other. But anyway, we had 2 types of government paperwork filled out to say that I'm a speaker at a horse expo, and so all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and we're going through immigration there, and they want to look at my computer. So they get my computer out, they start going through my emails. The guy says, where's your phone? And I pull my phone out and give it to him, and I said, but it's dead. And he goes, well, we'll have to wait till it charges. And so they plug it in and wait for the phone to charge, and you know, they're going through everything, going through Facebook, the whole bit. And about this time, my American wife leans across the table and she says, I feel like my rights are being violated. And he leans across the table, nose to nose with her, and he says, and what rights do you think you have?
Welcome to Canada, eh?
Yes. I mean, I think Canadians are the most wonderful people in the world. And if there's a bad egg, I think they give them a job in immigration because they're the only nasty Canadians I've ever met. But I've talked to 2 different clinicians who have been deported at gunpoint in Canada. One of them's a woman. But actually, it's the only place I've ever seen, Canadian immigration is the only place I've ever seen anybody taken away in handcuffs. And I think that's why, when that guy was going through my stuff, someone was taken away in handcuffs there. So yeah, Canadians are pretty serious about the immigration.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. You wouldn't think so, right? Because there's a reputation of a very welcoming country. You know, they need immigrants. But yeah, those men and women dressed in those navy blue suits, they can be really mean.
Yeah, they can. Okay, so crossing into Mexico. So you had to ride. So by this time you picked up the Mustang. You had to ride, take your 2 and have someone else take the other one.
Yeah, so this it was funny. I had to pay this kid. His name was Jesus. So I just put dude the Mustang into Jesus's hands. And he rode him across the Rio Grande. And in like 50 minutes, he's like, yep, dude is in Mexico. And then the other two quarter horses that I was doing legally, it was paperwork and money and bureaucracy. And basically after a couple weeks, we managed to get him in. And this is a really cool, you know, special part of the trip because I inherited this dream from my old man, right? My dad used to read the story to me every night. And he loved the story of Aim Chifley. And my dad met me in Ojinaga, the first town there on the border. And we crossed the Chihuahua Desert together, the first stretch, 7 days, just my dad and I, in the middle of this desert where 90% of the drugs coming into Canada and the U.S. cross. It's completely controlled by the drug traffic. And we're pitching the tent in the middle of nowhere. My dad snores like a grizzly bear. So obviously I'm not sleeping because everyone can hear us in a 30-kilometer radius outside the tent. But, you know, who gets to experience an adventure like that next to their old man? So that was one of the most special parts of the journey for me.
That's very cool. So tell us about you. I know in the book there's a part about a cartel, the head of a cartel hears that you're coming and invites you to his house. What country was that in?
So that was crossing from Guatemala into Honduras, a very dangerous part of the world. Honduras is the most dangerous country in the Americas, one of the most dangerous in the world due to the amount of deaths per capita. And because of all the problems I encountered, the further south I get at the borders, I ended up crossing almost all of them illegally. There's, you know, there's the physical real border, and then right next to it, there's always a little path where they cross anything and everything you want. And in order not to eat bullets, because in that part of the world, they don't ask questions, they shoot first. A rancher in Guatemala who was very worried about my safety put me in touch with the drug lord on the Guatemalan side. He put me in touch with the Honduran boss. And I wrote in to a episode of Narcos, literally, like, I'll never forget, like, it was this crazy mountain to climb. It was the rainy season, so it was muddy and these rocks, and I'm fighting my way up. It's 45 degrees, humid in the middle of a jungle. The horses can't breathe. Like, they're sweating profusely. They can't get their footing. So I have to walk one horse up 200 meters, go back, get the second horse, walk him up 200 meters, go back, get the third horse, walk him up 200 meters. I'm doing this all day. When I finally get to the other side in Honduras, the drug lord's waiting for me in this hole in the wall bar. And when I get there, he's like, oh, llegaste, you've arrived. And, you know, you haven't talked all day and your voice doesn't come out. I'm like, ah, sugar. And he tosses me a beer and it's a blue can. I look at it. It's called Salva Vidas, Lifesaver. I'm like, who is writing this script? And I just chug it. And I just chug this beer. And he's like, oh, you're thirsty, eh? I'm like, no, man, I'm shitting my pants. Like, I'm so scared. I didn't tell him that, but I was so scared. And then, yeah, he had a petting zoo in his mansion. He had a freaking mansion, a compound, and on the top of this mountain in the middle of nowhere. Everyone heavily armed, AK-47s, kids as young as 9 years old, carrying pistols. And but he treated me extremely well. You know, he was so kind to me. I couldn't look into his eyes. It was like everyone that you talk to has a spark in their eye. These people had like matte black eyes. Like you could see how much evil they harbored inside. But it's a huge contradiction, you know. A man that is so evil treated me so well, and it was all thanks to the horse. The horse is a common language. The horse makes brothers out of men who come from different countries and different realities, and the horse was the glue that always brought people and made even the worst of people kind around me.
And so you stayed, didn't you say you stayed with him for a couple of days?
Yeah, I stayed with him for 3 days, and then they rode out with me to kind of keep me safe to that northern region of Honduras.
So what do you do? What do you do in a drug lord's house for 3 days?
He drank a lot. He was an alcoholic. He would start drinking at like 10 a.m. He shook real bad. But just hung out with his kids. His kids were awesome. His wife is super nice. Talk about life. Go to see his cattle. He took me to see the hospital he had built for his community. He was very proud of where he came from. You know, he told me about how he was extremely poor and hungry as a child and started transporting, you know, this product with mules the same way that I was riding south. He was walking north, packing mules, and just kind of grew in the business. And today he's the boss. But just like a normal family, you know, and that's one of the cool and most important experiences that I've had on this journey, is that when you sit down with people at the dinner table, whether they're drug lords or judges or politicians, and, you know, independent of their color of skin, religion, socioeconomic background, we're all inherently the same. You know, we all just want to love and be loved. We want the best for our families. And I got to see that in 12 nations by the end of the trip.
So, you know, it was a pretty normal family apart from the AK-47s and the petting zoo.
Yeah, exactly. The tiger and the heavy artillery.
What did he have in his petting zoo?
He had a tiger. He had monkeys. He had deer. He had exotic birds. They're very, like, it's an ego thing, right? Like, they love to show off how much they have. You know, their guns are all have these beautiful plates on them made out of gold and silver. And their vehicles are always super nice. They have many nice vehicles. And he had like a table that was an exact replica of Jesus's last meal that he had spent like thousands of dollars to make and transport up there. Chandeliers everywhere in his house. Like, it was a real mansion. Very tall walls all around it. And the craziest thing, like the craziest story, which really showed me his power, was the first day I arrived, he threw like a little party, a little barbecue in his compound. And there was about, I don't know, 30, 40 people there. We're drinking, you know, we're eating meat. I'm like, where am I right now? Like, my mind's just having, you know, my mind is blown. And every time he had a BlackBerry, and every time his cell phone was about to die, he'd be like, who has battery in their BlackBerries? And people would like nervously fumble out their phones and show him how much battery they had. And he would pick the best one and make them take out their battery and put it into his phone and give them his drain battery. And I was like, wow, that's so crazy.
Did you ever relax in those 3 days, or were you like, this guy could just snap any minute?
No, I mean, a part of me as a journalist, you know, it was just like, oh my God, who gets this opportunity and who gets to experience this? Like, that was tremendous. But at the same time, yeah, I was never felt safe. You know, if the army came in, I was dead. If the other cartel came in, I was dead. If they, for some reason, turned on me and didn't like me anymore, you know, I could have been dead. So yeah, you don't relax for those 3 days.
That's scary. And that was in Honduras?
That was in Honduras, yeah. Northern Honduras, the border between Guatemala and Honduras.
You told, I don't know if I read in the book or heard in the podcast, or you told me, you know, people, there was some publicity about this, so people knew you were coming ahead of time. And didn't you say in Mexico that you had like 1,000 people ride with you and they had a mariachi band on the back of a truck or something?
Oh, yeah, that was two different times. So, yeah, no one celebrated my journey like the Mexicans. One day, 1,000 horsemen and women saddled their horses and rode with me all day. You know, some days it'd be 7, some days it'd be 10 people, but they just loved what I was doing and they wanted to get on their horse and ride with me. And some of the best horsemen I met. One day, a mayor hired a mariachi band, made them play at the back of a truck all day. Another mayor, this is the craziest story of all. I'm not going to finish the story, so everyone listening out there, Long Ride Home, that's the name of the book. You'll find the end of the story. I get to a town, the mayor throws me a party that lasts 3 days, mariachi band after mariachi band, like one finishes, the other one comes on. Everyone is drinking and copious amounts of alcohol. And the first night he takes me into his house and he says, Felipe, I'm very proud of you. You're like a son to me. What you're doing is extraordinary. I want to give you a present. And he walks me down this really dark hallway. And when we get to the last door, he opens it. There's a naked woman inside. And he goes, Carla, do whatever Felipe wants, and shuts the door.
And you guys will have to read the book to find out what happened.
It's not what you guys are thinking, so make sure you read the book.
Yeah, I have read that part of the book. I was just flipping through it, and I got to find out. Because I think on the podcast, the Gage podcast I listened to, you said that you got to read the book. And I was flipping through it, and I saw that, and I thought, yeah. And then when I read that, I knew that's how it was going to end out. But yeah, so you, what comes after Honduras?
From Honduras, we cross into Nicaragua.
Oh my goodness, what was that like? That's drug cartel central.
Yeah, well, Guatemala and Honduras were the worst. Like in Guatemala, I saw two people shot dead. First guy had stolen a rooster and a chicken. Second guy worked in the drug traffic. In the capital of Honduras, Tegucigalpa, I was staying in the home of a guy that tried to kill his wife with 5 gunshots. I was the only person staying there. But Nicaragua, although it is a huge corridor for the drug traffic, it's a little calmer. And it was beautiful. It was very special to me because my mom flew up. She came to ride with me. So she says, my mom has no horse experience, right? So she's like, if your father rode for 3 months through Mexico, I'm going to ride for a week. I'm like, mom, you're going to die. She's like, no, I'm going to ride. So I'm like, fine. So we get on the horse. First thing she says is like, this is how slow you travel. My mom thought I was like galloping through the Americas, right? And by the end of that first day, like when we got to the last 15 kilometers, she wanted to get off the horse. I'm like, mom, you can't. If you get off now, you're not gonna make it. Like you need to, you know, just go through the pain. It's gonna be okay. And we get to the end of the day and she just melts on the ground. I'm like, mom, we got another 4 days. You wanted to ride for a week. She's like, Felipe, I can't. I'm dying. She's like, just one day. I'm like, I know. So I had planned this like whole beach trip for us after. I knew it was only going to be one day, and we went to San Juan del Sur, a beautiful beach location. If everyone listening here, if you ever want to go to a gorgeous beach that has some of the most beautiful sunsets in the world, Nicaragua, San Juan del Sur. And my mom and I spent a couple days there. It was her birthday. It was my birthday. So it was really magical.
That sounds amazing. Pardon my South American lack of geography. What's after Nicaragua?
So after Nicaragua, we went into Costa Rica.
Oh, beautiful, okay.
Country as well. Yeah. First time that the horses saw the ocean. I thought they were going to love it. They were like so scared of the waves. They thought it was lava. So that was pretty funny. And but yeah, just so many animals. And, you know, we'd be riding monkeys, jumping from tree to tree and exotic birds. And it was a gorgeous part of the world to ride through.
Wowzers. And so you ended up, when you ended up in Brazil, you timed it to end up there at the big festival and rodeo, Barretas. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that like people ask me all the time. It's like, how did you arrive? You know, like when you're riding 10,000 miles, it's 803 days. How did you arrive the day you said you would, you know, for the first Saturday of the event? And I have no idea. Like that's some moments where I'm like, there's got to be a God, you know, there's got to be something greater because, you know, horses, like anything and everything can happen when you're riding like in your ranch, you know what I mean? Never mind crossing towns and cities. And that last stretch took me 5 days from Rio Preto, this small town, to Barretos. And those 5 days alone, you know, a million things could have happened. But we ended up arriving on the first Saturday of the largest rodeo in Latin America, 40,000 people in the stands. A helicopter hovering us, filming everything. I'm there with my kids, you know, doing what everyone said was impossible a couple years earlier. And it was one of the greatest moments of my life. I felt like my, you know, momentarily my spirit left my body and I was seeing everything from very far away. My family was there, my 90-year-old grandmother, people that had been important to the journey. It was a life-changing moment.
Well, let's talk about that because you have this life-changing moment, or you have this life-changing journey, really, that, you know, that 803 days. And from there, when you go back to Canada from there?
No, so I stayed in Brazil. There, I stayed in Brazil.
But didn't it all kind of come crashing down on you afterwards?
Oh, yeah, it came down real hard. So I do this, you know, lifelong dream. I accomplished it. I get to the homecoming party that, you know, with 40,000 people, they take me to see my statue after. They build a statue of the horses and I, more than 5 meters tall. And then I ride to my home. I retire the horses, spread Naomi's ashes. And that's when my life fell apart. Like I never would have imagined what was going to happen the next 6 months. You know, a huge vacuum was created. I lost purpose. Ultimately, you know, I'd fought for this dream for so long. It was so hard to undertake it. I'd seen so much, you know, it's literally like going to war, what I've done. And when I returned to my home and was separated from the herd, I had symptoms of PTSD, you know, I had depression, anxiety, reoccurring nightmares. I everywhere I went, people would say, oh, this is the guy that rode the horse from Canada to Brazil. And I didn't want to be that guy. Like, I lost my identity, I felt like, and then I went to do a talk at a children's cancer hospital in Brazil, and it was like God was shaking me, you know, like I had to go in there, and I I saw those kids, you know, a lot of them had lost their hair. Many had lost limbs, and they were fighting for their lives with a smile on their faces. And it was like, I was just shaken at that moment. And I was like, man, like I've done this tremendous thing. I need to get out of this funk. And that's when I started planning my second long ride from Brazil to Ushuaia to raise funds for that hospital and help those kids. But I see how dangerous it is today. You know, during that period, I just started drinking a lot, like a lot of people do. And one day I crashed my truck, almost died. You know, I made the mistake of getting in it drunk and I couldn't talk to people, you know, that's the other thing. Like I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed. I felt like no one would understand. I'm a cowboy, you know, we're cowboys. We don't talk about these things. So today, for anyone that's listening to this podcast right now, if you're going through something like that in your life, know that you can't and you shouldn't go through it alone. People will understand. People will support you through this. So please speak to people, because looking back at my life, I realized how dangerous that could have been, you know, and I just really felt ashamed. So talk to people.
Yeah, that's, you know, I've talked about a lot on the podcast before, but when you're ashamed of certain things and you think I couldn't talk to anybody about it, you find that when you do talk to people about it, instead of getting judgment, you kind of get, yeah, me too. I get where you're coming from.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And then you can lean on these people, you know, because they've been through, you know, what you've been through, and you realize you're not alone. Everyone goes through it. You know, you could be looking at someone's life and say, look how perfect it is, you know, like, or even my life at that moment, a lot of people didn't even know because, you know, I was all over television. I was about to release my first book. I had a statue of it. Like, who could have imagined I was going through this, this extremely hard moment. So like you said, when you talk to people and open up, you'll realize that it's not just you, you know, everyone goes through it.
Yeah. And it also, I think, you know, like this was a lifelong dream of yours, and you achieved it. And then afterwards you went into a deep depression. Was that because you achieved that thing and then you kind of have that, you know, that realization that, oh, I think I thought I'd feel different.
You know, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. You feel like you're going to become someone different, I think, in a way, you know what I mean? Like you're going to grow a third eye or get the sixth sense or, you know, like it's really crazy. And later, like no one prepared me for this. I had no idea, you know, and later watching a documentary that Michael Phelps did on Olympic athletes, not comparing myself at all to Olympic athletes, but they go through a lot of the same things. You know, you work your entire life for something, and then you achieve it, whether it's a gold medal or a bronze or just to be there, right? Just to represent your country. And a lot of them go through depression after because you lose purpose. You know what I mean? Like you forget to think about anything else. You focus so much on that goal and you think that goal is the almighty end, and it's not. You know, that moment gave me perspective on it's not the end of the road, it's the journey. You know, and I was always just so focused on getting to my hitos. I need to get there. That was a huge teaching moment for me that it's just right now. It's today. It's having this awesome conversation with this amazing horse trainer and it's going back and giving my fiance a hug and having lunch with her and seeing my friends tonight and not worrying about tomorrow or the next day and definitely not, you know, worrying about the past. All we have is right now, today, the present, and how we act right now is going to dictate the outcome of our future. And I find a lot of times as well, we really get caught up in the past and things that have happened to us. So again, you know, like this experience changed me as a person, but that moment hitting that rock bottom was probably one of the biggest life lessons to me. I think that we as people, we learn when we're suffering, you know, when things are good, they help us continue, but we don't learn any important lessons. But when you're suffering, I think we learn the most important lessons. And that was a huge lesson for me.
So let's talk about your second journey. So from Brazil, and then you went all the way down to Argentina, is that correct?
Yeah, Ushuaia, Argentina, the southernmost city on the planet known as the end of the world.
Wowzers. What is the... I know in your book it says you went to, it's a Spanish name.
Tierra del Fuego.
Yes, the land of fire. What is that?
So that is a small island just south of mainland Argentina, really close to Antarctica. And that's where this small town called Ushuaia is. And it's known as the land of fire because it's so cold there that when settlers first arrived, all of the indigenous people that lived on the island, they had to keep their fires going 24 hours a day throughout the entire winter. Like, they never let the fires out. So when you were coming in on a ship, it looked like the island was glowing with all these different bonfires everywhere. That's why it's known as the land of fire.
Wow. So how long after your Canada to Brazil journey did you undertake this second one?
About a year after I finished the first journey. So I went to that hospital, planned the second journey for a couple months, and then set off.
Did you use the same horses or did you get different horses?
No. So because of the borders and because everything Frenchie and Bruiser and Dude had been through, you know, they're literally like my children. I didn't want to take them out of their pasture and my family's home. So I retired them. And then the second journey, I did each country with its own horse. So I did Brazil with two quarter horse mares. When I got to the border with Uruguay, I sent the mares back to their owners, found two new mares in Uruguay, crossed that country, send them back. And then when I got to Argentina, how cool is this? The Solanet family, who started the Criollo breed in Latin America, Emilio Solanet, who was a vet, who lent Aim Chifley, Manchin Gato in 1925, the horses and the guy who inspired me, that family lent the two horses I rode through Argentina. And Criollos are the same lineage of Manchin Gato. And I started from their ranch in Buenos Aires, where the horses' bones are buried and where Aim Chifley's ashes reside. So that was just so crazy. Like, you know, and it's one of those moments where you're like, I'm on the right path. Like, I never imagined I would be riding through Argentina. My dream was to go from Canada to Brazil. And then there I am, like, in the middle of this second journey, trying to pick myself up and bring myself together, you know? And then the universe just gives me this gift. So that was super cool.
So let's talk about Argentina, because if you're going from Buenos Aires down to the bottom, you're basically going through the Andes, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Crossed the Andes several times, spent months in Argentina, crossed it from north to south. I spent 7 months in Patagonia. I always say, for people that haven't been to Patagonia, if heaven and hell could coexist in perfect harmony, that place would be Patagonia. It's some of the most beautiful lighting I've ever seen in my life. The snow-capped Andes, you know, just the colors of the rivers and the lakes, they're like blue, just like Jasper and Banff in Canada, for those that have seen those national parks. So just a beautiful ride. And the Argentinian people, you know, the gauchos, they love horses. So just like in Mexico, they really celebrate my journey.
And is that where you met Clara? You gotta tell us that story.
Yeah, that's the greatest story of my life, you know. So I get to I'm in Argentina, I'm in northern Argentina still, and I meet this lady. And she gives me a bracelet, a woman's bracelet, before I leave her house. And I'm like, so confused. I'm like, why is this woman giving me a woman's bracelet? And she's like, Felipe, this is for you to give to your soulmate. She's like, you're going to meet your soulmate on this journey. I'm like, lady, are you blind? Like, look at me. My clothes is ripped up. I have a beard. I smell bad. Like, I'm riding a horse across, you know, Argentina. If I can't meet a woman in my house, you think I'm going to meet a woman like in this? And she goes, no, take it. So I take the bracelet. And sure enough, a couple months go by. I get to this little town called El Bolson. And a couple days earlier, I was riding with a friend of mine, Totti, and I had met a park ranger. And he said, hey, I live in a town a couple days from here. When you guys get there, I'm going to host you at my house. I have two stepdaughters. My wife's going to love you guys. They love horses. And we don't think anything of it. And we continue south. And when we get to this town called El Bolson, there's this huge billboard outside of town that says, welcome to El Bolson this weekend, the beer festival. And Totti and I are like, yes, we never got anywhere when there's anything going on, right? You're always late on horseback. So we're so excited. We're talking about this festival, how there's going to be tons of girls there. There's going to be alcohol. We're going to have the time of our lives. And sure enough, when we get to the rodeo grounds where we're going to rest the horses, there's the park ranger. And Totti and I look at each other. We're like, oh, no. He's here. We're going to have to go to his house and tell stories to the family all night. We're not going to be able to go to the beer festival. So we quickly devise this plan. We're like, okay, so we'll tell them that we got to shoe the horses tonight. You know, we got to find shoes and we got to find nails and we can't go to his house. But we'll go tomorrow. Thank you very much. But we'll go tomorrow. Deal, deal, deal. So we ride up. And when I get to the park ranger and I turn the corner, I see Clara, my fiance today. And it was literally like love at first sight. And this guy goes, boys, welcome to my town. You know, we're here. These are my stepdaughters. We'd like to invite you to eat pizzas at our house tonight. And I look at him. I'm like, pizzas? I love pizza. And Tati's like looking at me being like, what happened to the plan? I'm like, screw the plan, bro. I'm going after this girl. And yeah, I fell in love with her. And she was really real tough, real hard to get. I gave her the bracelet. She gave it back to me. She thought I had like a box of like made in China bracelets I was handing out from Canada to Argentina. And but you know, cowboys, the harder they buck, the harder we want to ride them. So I just fell in love with her, and I just kept working at it, working at it. And eventually she realized that I was being truthful, and she came out to ride with me a few weeks later. And then she was there in Ushuaia when I arrived, and she actually went on this last long ride with me. We had a support vehicle from Alaska to Calgary. She was by my side. And when I got to the Calgary Stampede and finished the Americas in 2020, I asked her hand in marriage.
That's, you know, that's a great story. And I can see why it would be love at first sight. She's absolutely beautiful inside and out. Like there's a yes, light, there's a light that shines out of her. That's, yeah, she's amazing. So you just talked about the third journey you did. So you went from, is it Fairbanks, Alaska?
Yep, Fairbanks, Alaska, to the Calgary Stampede. I started that journey in 2019 with two wild horses from the Osoyoos Indian Band in the Okanagan Valley of Canada. They're like Mustangs they have in the U.S. They call them Wildies or Wild Horses in Canada. And that was a very hard journey as well. It was the shortest of the three, but it was just through some of the toughest terrain in the world, you know, like the northern part of Alaska and then the Yukon and northern BC. It's just, there's so much muskeg up there, you know, as soon as you get out of the Alaska highway. So there's no ranches, there's no farms, there's no nothing. You just literally ride, you know, 500 miles, get to a town, ride another 500 miles of nothing, get to the next town, and plagued with grizzly bears. I was crossing like three bears a day. Got snow in the middle of summer in the Northern Rockies. The mosquitoes are like the size of helicopters and they just want to just eat you alive. But I had Clara there with me. We had a support vehicle for this stretch. So we were able to carry hay and water and feed for the horses. So that ended up helping tremendously.
You said a minute ago something about muskeg. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
What is that?
So muskeg is like that really boggy terrain. Like it's pretty marsh. It's like a marsh. Oh. You know, when you walk through it and it looks like you're walking on a waterbed because there's just so much water. And if you put a horse through, it's just bog. The horse will just sink and it'll eat it alive. That's all it is up there. There's just so much water, so much marsh.
And so did you have to, can you go around it or you got to go through it?
No, so they build the Alaska Highway using like tons of, they would cut down trees and first they would put these logs, then they would just dump a tremendous amount of rocks on top and dirt and more rocks. So literally the only place I could ride was follow this Alaska Highway. And as soon as you get like 5 meters off the highway, you're sinking. So you have to stay pretty close to it, which was another challenge because I'm on these wild horses and there's transport trucks flying by next to us and a lot of close calls, a lot of mounds, you know, switchbacks and not a lot of space on the road. So that ended up making it super hard as well.
And that is that highway goes all the way down to...
Yeah, that highway goes from Dawson Creek, Canada, all the way up to Alaska, to Fairbanks.
And so you went all the way down through that and then down into British Columbia and then across to Alberta. Is that how you went?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Through northern British Columbia, the Northern Rockies, up onto Grand Prairie, Alberta, and then south towards the Calgary Stampede. Another huge hurdle that we faced on this last journey was, you know, what everyone has just gone through. This pandemic nearly ended my ride. You know, I was chosen to be the Calgary Stampede Grand Marshal, which was like the biggest honor of my life. And then they canceled the rodeo for the first time in 100 years and canceled my parade. I'm like, wah, wah, wah. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to keep going. And thank God I did, because when I arrived, things were kind of starting to open up, and the president managed to get the city to allow me to ride in with him and Clara and the police. And it was the only event the Calgary Stampede ended up having that year. And I was given the keys to the city by the mayor. I was white hatted by the mayor of Calgary, and it was a really cool experience.
Wow. That is so cool. I'm just looking at them. I'm just, while you're talking here, I'm just looking at a map on my computer, and I'm like, holy cow. I'm doing
it. I encourage everyone to do that. That's a, you know, while they listen to this podcast, open a map so you have the dimension of what I've done, you know, to look at Alaska and then look at Ushuaia. And you'll begin to understand, you know, like I always tell people, for you to understand what I've done, there's 12 people have walked on the moon. More than 5,000 people have summited Everest, but only 4 men have crossed the Americas on horseback. And I'm one of them, and the youngest.
That's amazing. So looking at this map here, you didn't mention Colombia. What was Colombia like?
So I didn't go through Colombia. When I got to Panama, we ended up having some huge problems with the borders, like we talked about at the beginning of this podcast. And they didn't allow my horses in. They had a rule where the horse had to stay 6 months to a year in the country prior to exportation and importation. Because my horses had to cross so many countries, we didn't get to go into Panama. And that's when, like, all the problems began. It almost ended my journey. Then I was looking at how am I going to ship these horses to South America, and the Brazilian Ministry of Agriculture was helping me at the time. And they told me that if we went into Colombia or Venezuela, we couldn't go into Brazil because there was an equine virus there that doesn't exist in Brazil. So those countries were shot out. We couldn't go into Ecuador because there was no boats or flights that would take us there. The only country we could get into was Lima, Peru, the capital of Peru, but a horse had never been exported from Costa Rica to Peru. So I ended up having to raise $16,000. I ended up being stopped there for so many days. I almost pulled my hair out of my head. I almost left the horses behind and got new horses to finish the trip. But they were like my kids at this point, right? We had been traveling for more than a year. There was this, like, I'm like, how am I gonna leave my kids behind, you know? So I fought, I raised the funds, did all the paperwork, everything I needed, and we ended up going to Lima, Peru, and then continuing the journey from there, from Peru to Bolivia, from Bolivia to Brazil.
So you were in Costa Rica, and that's where you shipped them down to Lima, Peru?
Yeah, to Lima, Peru.
Okay. Because I was looking at the map here, and I'm like, Colombia? You didn't say anything about Colombia. That's got to be crazier than... You know,
it was my dream. It was one of my favorite countries to go through. And unfortunately, due to this bureaucracy, we weren't able to, but I'd love to go back. It's an amazing country. It's really gotten cleaned up from the 80s and 90s when we hear about all the drug cartels and all that. It's super safe now, which is unfortunate because, you know, there's still a demand. So they all just moved to Mexico and Central America. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing in those regions of the world. But I would love to go to Colombia, and a huge horse culture as well. The Paso horse is very... the gated horses are very big there.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I might get to some of these questions before we get too much further, because I'm just excited about what your answers might be, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So your first question that you chose was, if you could spread a message, what would it say? Like, if you could spread a message to the whole world, what would it say? Or your favorite quote, whichever one you like.
So I'll say both. My favorite quote, and it has to do with my answer, is a John Wayne quote that goes, courage is being scared half to death, but saddling up anyway. And that's something I hear all the time from people. Oh my God, you're so courageous. And, you know, how did you do this? You're so brave. And it's like what my dad used to tell me when I was a little kid, you know, fear is a monster that inhabits our mind. And if we don't push it aside, we do nothing with our lives. You know, it's an instinct. It's a survival instinct that has built from years and years and years of survival of the fittest. I love studying the brain. And I know today that literally it's just trying to keep me safe from when we lived in caves and there was bears and tigers out there that were going to eat us. It's a part of our central nervous system. And I find that a lot of people don't take that first step because of those little voices in their head. You know, you can't do it. You're not strong enough. You're going to die. everything that I was fighting before I took that. So what I'd like to tell people is that, yes, you can. You know, it takes an unforgivable amount of work. It takes focus. It takes strategic planning, determination, but absolutely nothing is impossible when you're willing to work for it. When you're willing to saddle those horses and ride 20 miles a day, you can cross continents. Luck doesn't exist. You know, we always have a tendency to look at other people and say, oh, well, if I was a millionaire, I'd be able to do that as well. And, you know, that's the way for us to be like, well, that's why I can't do it. Stop doing that. Write it down. Start planning your dream and live it. Because if there's one thing I learned in this life is that this opportunity goes by really quick.
Great, great message. So what next question you chose was, what do you feel is your true purpose in the world?
I think that's it. You know, this, I think shaking people up. Because when you see my documentary, when you read my book, there's no way you can look me in the eyes and say like, oh, I can't do this because X, Y, and Z. Because I was a kid that had no money. I'm an immigrant from Brazil that got a scholarship to go to school, worked two jobs to pay the bills, and worked on my project at night. Like, I should not be here today telling you my story on this podcast. So I just want to shake people up and tell them, stop giving me excuses. You can't BS me. Just go and do it. Everyone has limitations, fears, and problems. But when you want it bad enough and willing to work for it, you can do whatever the hell you want.
You know, it's funny. After we met at the Horse Expo in Columbus, Ohio, between then and now, you've listened to a few episodes of the podcast. So before we got on here, I asked you which ones you'd listen to, and one of the ones was Heather Swan, who held the, yes, you know, held the world record for the world's highest wingsuit base jump. And I mean, you and her are very, very similar in like your planning and your approach to things. And yeah, listening to her, especially listening to her, you know, she was 40 and not an adventurer. And then after that, did all these amazing things. And yeah, it's just it's a great way of looking at the world.
I definitely really related to her listening to your podcast. And for everyone listening, if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it after this, because it's, you're going to take so much from it. It's such a special episode, and her outlook and what she was able to do. And another thing I hear a lot, I heard this last night, I had a showing for my film, and I hear this all the time. It's probably what I hear about most. Oh my God, that would have been my dream, but I'm too old. No, you're not too old. Age is a state of mind. Look what she was able to do. She was 40, right? When she started training for this. Yeah, she was 40. You know, I know a guy that at the age of 86 went on a 1,000-mile long ride on a horse, 86 years old. So again, we all have excuses that allow us to live this safe, comfy life. But if you truly want it, there's no age, there's no limitation, there is nothing. And just take a second here, Warwick, to thank Katerina, who put us in touch in Ohio and took us out to dinner. You know, you never know why you're going to meet people in this life. Like I said at the beginning of this, I'm a huge believer in destiny, and everything's already written. I'm not sure why I had to meet you. Maybe it's to record this podcast. Maybe it's something we don't even know yet or can't even imagine. And Katerina's the same way, but I met her randomly and she put me in touch with you. And today we're here doing this. So how cool is that? You know, life is so awesome.
You know, I'd had several people contact me about having you on the podcast before I even went back there. So your name was like, your name was on my radar. And what was funny was going into the Horse Expo that morning. So I'm outside in my rental car, and there's a big line to get into the Horse Expo, and I'm sitting in traffic out there, and Katerina happens to be walking along this street. And so I've met her several times before, and I roll the window down. I go, hey, how's it going? And she sounds good. And so I said, hop in and I'll drive in. So she gets in the car with me. I haven't seen her for several years. I go in, get my booth set up, whatever, and then somehow she meets you, and the booth you're in is basically right behind my booth, and that place is huge. I mean, you know, there's multiple buildings with trade show booths in them all over the place, and your booth just happened to be behind me, and the lady that I gave a ride to that morning happens to meet you, and she comes around, and she goes, you got to meet this guy, he's blah, 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 and I'm like, hell, I want to meet him, I've heard all about him. So, yeah. It was meant to be, I'm with you. I don't think, I mean, this podcast is part of the purpose of this meeting, but I think there's more to it. What else there is, I don't know, but that's the feeling I get. Okay, next question for you, and this is a great question for you. What advice would you give someone about to enter your occupation? And when I ask this question on the podcast, I've always got to say, now you need to quantify what your occupation is, because, you know, are you a journalist? Are you a long rider? Are you a motivational speaker? Are you a filmmaker? So you got to kind of quantify. Maybe you're all of those, and maybe you've got advice for people doing all of those different things.
So I will encompass all of it. And but long riding, I think, you know, if anyone wants to go into it, but this you can use in all those occupations. And number one is patience. Patience is extremely important. You know, we live in an age today where we think things are going to happen from today to tomorrow. And you study any success story out there, whether it's from a musician, a horse trainer, a journalist, a long rider, and it takes 10,000 hours. It takes 10,000 days. It takes years. You know, it took me 10 years to go from this idea to my finished documentary. You know, and I find that today people give up way too soon. So if you want to make it in whatever it is you're doing, have patience and wait it out and persistence. And the second is flexibility. You know, you can plan it. Strategic planning, like I said at the beginning of this, is the difference between success and failure. But don't have expectations. Plan for the worst, hope for the best, but ultimately take what comes and be flexible. You know, oh, so what? I couldn't get into Panama. I was heartbroken. I couldn't get into Colombia. That was my plan. I had friends there waiting for me. I had contacts. I'd planned. I had drawn the route. But all of a sudden, I encountered this huge problem. And was I going to sulk about it and cry and let the journey end? Or was I going to throw the plan out the window and find a window, jump through it, and draw a new plan? And that's what I did. And ultimately, that's why I ended up surviving and finding success in my life and my projects. You know, you can't win every battle, but you can sure as hell win the war. And that's what it's all about.
That's amazing. Okay, so what quality do you admire in a person?
Humility. Some of the greatest people I've ever met in my life had achieved extraordinary things, but they were humble. And, you know, we all go to the same hole. We all go to the same place at the end of this. You know, we don't know what comes in next, but I meet a lot of people that have done absolutely nothing but have this, like, this thing about them, you know, like this attitude, like they're better. And like I said, when you go on a journey like this and you have to literally knock on people's doors and ask for help, you see that we're all inherently the same, you know, and that's why it's so upsetting to see what we're seeing right now with Russia and Ukraine. And I feel like if Putin had gone on a long ride, you know, he might think twice about killing innocent people, and because they're just like his kids and his wife and his family, you know, they're just, the flag's different, but so what? So yeah, man, I really value humility and people that are humble.
You know, something you just said in there made me think of a question. So, you know, every once in a while I'll be somewhere, especially at nighttime, like in nature where the sky is huge and it just, you know, like the stars are out, and I don't know, it just makes you feel small, like very, very small and insignificant. I bet you had a lot of that. Because some of the places you would have been, the scenery would have been absolutely amazing, wouldn't it?
You know what, Work? You might have just touched on the central theme of my story. I think that that's very interesting what you just said, because I felt like that all the time, you know, whether it was the cities I was crossing at 3 kilometers an hour, you know, or the mountains or the deserts, or those skies, like you're just saying, I saw so many of those. Of those skies, you know, whether I was sleeping in Yellowstone or Wyoming or the Chihuahua Desert or Patagonia, when the next town is whatever, 1,000 miles away. And yeah, you literally, it hits home that we're just a grain of sand. We're so minute. And yeah, that might be one of the most special parts, you know, because I think that grounds you. I think, like I said, that keeps you humble. That makes you understand that we're literally nothing, you know, you just, like, even if you live 100 years, what is that based on the history of the universe? You know, that's nothing. It's like a little fart. So yeah, it just, yeah, that's very interesting you said that.
Well, you were talking about humility, and there's something about, I think there's just something about being places like that make you feel really small, that gives you a lot of humility.
I think horses have a tendency to do that as well to us, you know. Could be the best rider in the world, you know. When you eat sand that one time, you know, you're like, God damn it. They have a really good way of keeping us humble, animals and nature. And that was ultimately one of the goals for this journey, you know. It was to inspire people. It was to share the realities of the Americas. But ultimately, it was for myself to reconnect with nature. You know, we live in a world today where we're so, you know, we're going deeper and deeper into our phones and our computers, and that's all fine and dandy, but it really scares me for our future when kids don't know where their food comes from, when kids have never touched the dirt and dug their hands into it and seen a plant grow and having accountability and realizing what kind of footprint you have on this earth. And it really upsets me when people put all the blame and everything on ranchers and farmers, you know, for the changing climate and this and that, because I feel like those are the real stewards of the land, you know, the people that I met that took me into their homes, hardest working people I've met. But this connection to the earth and to the animals not only keeps them humble, but it shows them what's actual truth and what's BS. And I think we're missing that a little bit in big cities and in modern society.
Yeah, there's something, what's the saying, you know, you can... Oh, it was a like a farming type saying, and it's something you can't plan for. I've lost it, but it's all about that connection with nature, and yeah, I can't think of the saying, but it'll come to me here in a minute. But I'll ask you your next question, or your last question, and I'm really excited about this because maybe you've already covered this, but. What's the luckiest thing that ever happened to you? I know you don't believe in luck.
Yes, I don't believe in luck. But the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, I talked about it, was meeting Clara in Patagonia. Like, what are the chances, right? Like I said, I couldn't meet the love of my life in my town, like where I could shower and shave and wear clean clothes. You know, I never imagined I was going to fall in love and literally meet my soulmate. Like, she feels like nothing less than the person I was put on this earth to be next to. And I had to ride thousands of kilometers to get there and meet her. So, and again, just a testament of how important it is for us to follow our instincts and follow our purpose on this life. You know, we all have a path. We're all here for a reason. I truly believe in that. And when you listen to that little voice in your heart, in the pit of your stomach, makes the butterflies go off because you're like, oh my God, it's so scary. I can't do it. That's what we're meant to do. And when you do that, you meet the love of your life on a horse. In an age where everyone meets the love of their life through Tinder, I was meeting it the old-fashioned way, right? It wasn't a white horse, but that was the – I feel so blessed and so lucky to have met her.
Yeah. You know, the night we went out to dinner and you would tell me the story about the bracelet, and I said to her, are you wearing it? And she said, actually, no, I'm not wearing it right now, because she said, I've got this loosely knitted sweater it catches on, but apparently she still wears it all the time.
Yeah, she at the movie premiere, she has to wear it because people are like, where's the bracelet? And all the women come up to her after, want to see the bracelet. And yeah, she still wears it. But I'm officially going to lose it. I'm like, we need to like make it into a necklace or something, because it comes easily undone. So it's very worrisome at times when she wears it.
So what is next for you?
So right now, like we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, going to the festivals around the world with the documentary, The Long Rider. I'm finishing my third book. It's going to be called Last Long Ride. That'll be out by the end of the summer. And we're actually working on the narrative version of my first book, Long Ride Home. That's going to become a movie with actors. And the script is done right now. We are location scouting, and that's going to go into production next year in July. June, July, we're going to start filming it. It's going to be shot in Canada, Mexico, and Brazil, and I'm super excited about it because, number one, the actor is going to be way better looking than me and ripped, so that's awesome. And the other part is that when I was out there, like, I was shooting this all myself, so sometimes I would see this epic sunset, and I was like, man, if we could climb that mountain right now and have a beautiful camera, you know, like a red epic camera, shooting a guy on a horse right here, this would be the most beautiful shot in the world. And now we get to do that with the crew, with a director, you know, with a real director of photography and these actors. So I am super stoked. And hopefully the idea is to make a film for every book. So in the end, it'll be three films about the entire journey.
You know, every once in a while, someone will get asked a question like, if you were to make a movie about your life, who would play you? So who are you going to get to play you?
Well, Brad Pitt's too old, but he's the only one that really looks like me. So it's tough. You know? No, we already have our lead actor. I can't announce it yet, but he's a Brazilian superstar. He is beautiful. And the most important thing is that he actually wants to make this film. I gave him the book years ago before it was even going to become a movie. And he's an adventurer himself. And that's what attracted me to him, to bring him into the project. And I finally convinced our producers and directors that he's the guy. And we're going to announce it very soon. And I'm very excited for him to play me on the screen.
That is very cool. I know. So that movie's about the first trip?
Yeah, that's going to be just about the first trip, Canada to Brazil, long ride home.
Okay. Well, I know who should play Clara in one of the later ones. Actually, you can't do that because... Oh, I was going to say Penelope Cruz, but you know, like rewind Penelope Cruz back to Clara's age because she's, you know, totally. she has that accent. Talking to her the night we went to dinner, she sounds like, so have you ever seen a movie with Tom Cruise and Penelope Cruz called Vanilla Sky?
Oh, yeah.
And she says to him, I will tell you in another life when we are both cats. Just the way she talks, listening to Clara that night at dinner, it's like, oh, you could say that and it would be so Penelope Cruz.
Can you just record this for me? Yeah, she is. I could definitely see it. And you're right, we'd have to go back a couple of years, but that's the look that we're definitely going to have to find. Totally agree.
Exactly, yeah. After we met in Ohio, I kind of started following you on Instagram. And I look back at some of your old videos, and there was a video of you in Patagonia riding along, and the winds were, I don't know how fast the winds were, but you just looked like you were absolutely miserable. It was freezing cold, and the wind was almost blowing you off your horse. What was the temperature, and how strong were those winds?
Oh, it was terrible. That was some of the most, the most suffering I endured on the entire journey. It was just months at a time, 120 kilometers an hour. It's like being in one of those tunnels where they test airplanes. Yeah. The horses stumbled like walking. That's how strong it was. And it was minus 15. I would wear like 30 layers of clothing. I had like a slicker on that had a hood, and I would close the hood just so my eyes were out, and sunglasses. It was just to saddle the horses. You know, you put the blanket on and go get the saddle and the blankets and chili. Like it was just living was hard and surviving. And yeah, that was really tough.
How long were the conditions like that?
Oh, it would last like weeks, and then it would stop for a day or two, and then the wind would pick up again for another couple of weeks. It was, I was tested, and people ask me all the time, it's like, did you ever think about quitting? And it's like, I thought about quitting every day. Like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. Like, this is just literally like going to war, and you know, you have a problem or 30. But again, that's why it's so important to find your purpose and have that with you all the time, because it's easy to give 110% in the easy days when we wake up happy and everything's going our way. But how about when the wind's blowing at 120 kilometers an hour, or your horses are hurt, or you've had an epic fight with your spouse, or your kids are in the hospital? You know, what's going to make you get up and give 110%? And to me, it's that feel, you know, it's that goal at the end of the road. It's that purpose that just, you know, I was doing this for a cancer hospital and for those kids. So I would close my eyes and take them there, and I just knew that quitting was never an option, and I would continue on.
You know, that was going to be my question, is when it got really, like you just said, I'd close my eyes. When it got, you know, when it got really tough, what did you do? That was going to be my question. What did you do to push through that?
Visualize. You talked about this on the podcast as well. The power of the mind, you know, our mind can't differentiate from things that, you know, have actually happened and things that we imagine. Like, how crazy is that? You know, it's unbelievable. This muscle that we have is just, and like they've done studies where I read an English study where they got a group of people to actually work out for 15 minutes every day, and a group of people to think that they were working out for 15 minutes every day. And the group that thought they were working out for 15 minutes a day, their muscles actually grew after an extended period of time, you know, just from visualizing it. And And that's what I did. You know, in that first journey, when the bullets were flying, when the moments were tough, I would close my eyes and take myself to my family. I would literally transport myself to my family's embrace, to Bajitos, entering that arena. Like, I could feel it. I was there. Before I left, when I didn't have a single horseshoe, no horses, no money, no nothing, I'd close my eyes and I would imagine myself riding out of the Calgary Stampede. Like, literally feel it. Like, you gotta, you know, if your dream is to, like, ride a horse out of Calgary, I was on top of that horse in the saddle. I could hear the creaking of the saddle. I could hear the horse's hooves hitting the ground. I could hear the announcer. I could feel that Calgary hot summer day, the reins in my hand. And on that second journey, it was those kids. I would go to that hospital. I would see their smiles. I would hear their stories. I would, you know, feel their embrace. And that's what allowed me to finish these journeys.
Yeah, there's a lot. So back up a bit, a few years for us. But when my wife and I went to the World Equestrian Games in 2018, we had a mental coach. And one of the things she had my wife do was imagine the feeling after it happens successfully. Like, you know, you compete and you do really well, you know, you do what you're supposed to do. And what's that feeling afterwards? And that was, she didn't have me do it, but she had my wife do it. And it was, Robin said that was one of the things that got her to be good there was anticipating that feeling of how it was going to feel afterwards. Another question I had for you was, when you were riding, what's the biggest physical challenge riding that far? Were you, like, was it your hips? Was it your knees? Was it your ankles? Were you rubbed raw? Did you have any of that sort of stuff going on?
No, it's funny. Everyone always asks, like, how is your ass? Like, that's everyone's first question. But it was my knees, my lower back, and on my last journey, my groin. Like, I think I'll always have groin problems just because some of those horses were so wide and I was spending so much time on top of them. And those are the biggest pains I felt. Like, some of the days the knees would be screaming, the lower back. And the hardest part is that, you know, it's not actually riding the horse 8 to 10 hours a day. It's sleeping on top of your saddle blankets in the tent, no shower, get up the next day, do it again, sleep on the saddle blankets at night, get up the next day. You know, you never really rest. And then after a week, then you finally sleep in a real bed and shower. And then, you know, you hit the reset button. But when you're out there on the trail, you know, it's just, there's never an easy day. And I'd say riding is the easy part. It's setting up tent, it's highlining the horses and finding a place to sleep and going to find water for them. And that's the really hard part.
Yeah, at the end of the day when you've done all that riding.
Yeah, exactly. Like, now you have to, you know, do another million things before you can actually go to bed on top of the saddle pad.
Right. You know, I don't know if I told you that when we went to dinner that night, but a couple of years ago, my son and I went to Mongolia and rode camels across the Gobi Desert in the middle of winter. And
wow.
And the camels, they walk, they trot. Well, they don't actually trot, they pace, and they will canter every once in a while. But in my experience, the cantering only happens right before they're going to buck. But you spend some time walking, but most of the time you spend trotting, and they have like three speeds. And one is this really slow, like Western pleasure jog that you can sit to. And then there's a really fast trot they'll do that actually propels you up and down so you can post easily. But the thing you spend most of the time doing is in the middle, which is a speed that you've really got to engage your core to sit to it. Or if you want to post, you actually have to do like squats. You've got to stand yourself up and sit yourself down and stand yourself up and sit yourself down. And for me, it was there were days where my knees and ankles, it was just, you know, really quite painful and really had to focus on getting through it. And I was thinking, that's why I asked you, were you walking most of the time?
I walked not most of the time, but a lot of the time. Like, I would walk probably 5 to 10 kilometers every day. So like about 5 miles a day. You're riding 20, you walk 5.
No, I mean, on the horse. Walk, was your
oh
your
yeah
horse speed walking?
Always at a walk.
So you're walking the whole time. Okay, yeah.
Yes, sir, yeah. And then you try to get across bridges and stuff like that, but for the most part, you're walking.
Yeah, okay. So you like, would you take your feet out of the stirrups and let your feet dangle and things like that?
Oh yeah, 100%. I'd always have my feet out of the stirrup. My stirrups were dropped down. You know, I wasn't cutting. That's for sure. My stirrups were as far down as I could.
No, and I noticed that on the camels. Like you get to where, you know, when your knees and your ankles are just killing you, that if you have the chance and you can drop your feet out. You just got to be careful that the camel doesn't spook at something while you got your feet dropped down.
Oh my God, I can't imagine on a camel. That's epic.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Where am I going to go now? There's just so many questions I got for you. You did say what's next, didn't you?
Yeah, so I talked about, these projects that I'm finishing up, but I would like to say that my ultimate goal, you know, at the end of this, it's all, I'm climbing a ladder right now. Like I hope to one day have a show like the great late Anthony Bourdain, but instead of showing culture through food, like he did so well, I would like to show culture through the horse and Western culture, you know?
Wow. That'd I find be such that, a great idea.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for saying that. I just find that today with the, you know, this globalization, if you go to Tokyo, Sao Paulo, Melbourne, it's all going to be the same. The kids are going to be dancing the same TikTok. You're going to eat McDonald's. The music's going to be the same. But when you go to those small towns, you know, to the rural communities and the ranches and the farmers, you're really able to get a taste of culture. So I'm excited to jump into that soon.
I'd love to see that TV show. So tell us about your motivational speaking. What sort of places do you get asked to go to, and what sort of things do you tell people?
So that's pretty cool. That's something I never imagined would happen. You know, today I pay my bills motivational speaking. Like I speak to large companies around the world, usually to sales teams or at the end of the year conferences, beginning of the year. And I talk about strategic planning. I talk about, working in a team. I talk about resiliency. I discuss several themes that are able to go from the ride to the business world, you know, to their daily life. And, you know, these guys set quotas that sometimes may seem impossible. And then I get on the stage and they realize that, holy shit, I'm complaining about having to, you know, sell $1 million worth of whatever, the computer systems. And this guy was able to ride 25,000 kilometers on a horse through the Americas. Like, I have nothing to complain about. And I kind of light a fire under their ass. And I also do a lot of motivational speaking to young kids in schools. I have different projects on the go where, the kids get to read my book and they study geography through the book and in Brazil, Portuguese, and how to write stories. And then I also do a talk for them and we talk about their life goal and their life projects and what they're doing today to ensure that they're living those projects in the future. So I'm just truly blessed. You know, I get to travel all over the Americas and meet cool people and share my story. And I get a lot of amazing feedback from people that, you know, maybe didn't feel like they were smart enough to go to university or had this dream that seemed really far away. But when they heard my talk or read my book, it just kind of gave them that little push. You know, I like to be the pusher. I push people over the edge. You know, I always say when you're going to jump off a cliff or a bridge, onto a lake, or if you're bungee jumping, you've done this, I know, the longer you stand up there and look down, the higher it gets, right? And the more scary it gets. So you literally have to just go there and jump. So when people don't want to jump, I'm the guy that just gives them a little nudge.
Yeah, that quote, that John Wayne quote you said before is, courage is being scared to death and saddling up anyway. You know, you kind of suggested people push through that, and it's like the bungee jumping was one of those things to where it's like it standing there looking over the edge of that thing and then having to force your body to do it, because you know, like jumping out of a plane, the first time you jump out of a plane you're usually strapped to somebody, they're strapped to your back and they go and you just happen to go with them. But the bungee jumping, no one's gonna push you off that thing. You've actually got to get yourself to push, you know, and it's, you're actually fighting with yourself, because part of you is trying to save you, and you've got to override that. And that's, and bungee jumping and doing a lot of other things too. But yeah, that's a skill, I think. And I think if you can start small and work your way up, you know, don't, don't do the thing that you can't do. Do something that's outside your comfort zone that you can do. And then what I think you find is then it's easier to go, okay, I'll take a big, you know, I'll take a big leap now, because you practice pushing through that stuff. I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And it's like, I always use horses as an example. You know, you can't just get on a green horse and ask them to turn a barrel pattern. You got to train it. And our minds are the same way. We are the same way. You know what I mean? You have to train your mind. And it's exactly what you said. You know, you start with small things, and all of a sudden you're able to do these extraordinary things. But you got to take that first step. You know, I love a quote that is, you don't have to be extraordinary to take that first step, but you do have to take the first step in order to become extraordinary. And yeah, it starts with little things. And there's a great power in that when you're able to, because we're our worst enemies, right? When you're able to silence that voice, when you're able to silence that fear, that monster, and actually do it, you come out the other side feeling like Superman, right? Like first time I rode a bull, like I felt like I could fly after. The adrenaline was just propelling me to greater heights, you know what I mean? And that adrenaline can be used for you. You know, you hear about athletes talking about that all the time, about soldiers. You know, you get this like extra, you know, almost superhero like power in the last stretch, which is the adrenaline that your body is releasing to keep you alive. Again, it's all goes back to survival. And so anyways, I love the human mind. It's unbelievable what we can achieve.
Yeah, well, you know what I love about your story is, and you said it on here, and you said it the night I think we went to dinner. You know, you did this amazing thing that people go, oh, I could never do that sort of thing. But then you start out your story with, I was a scared little boy. I was scared of everything. And so,
100%.
You know, that I think that's probably, to me, that's probably the most important part for everybody. It's not like you're a bit like Heather Swan, who, you know, at 40 was not adventurous at all, and then pushed herself to, you know, break a world highest wingsuiting base jumping record. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's, you know, apart from your whole story about what you did, but the, you know, because I think we're all wired a bit different, and some people are pretty gung-ho and others aren't. And I think the ones that aren't that gung-ho, the ones that have a lot of natural fear, think that they're stuck with it. I mean, I'm that way, and I always thought for the longest time I'm just stuck with it, you know.
And exactly.
Yeah, as you learn to push through it, and I was later in life when I started to learn to push through things. So, you know, it's never too late to start.
It's never too late to start, and you're right. And I think that's what makes my story so relatable, right? Is that people see themselves in it. Someone told me the other day when I finished my talk, he's like, "Man, the other day we got a guy in here. He was a Olympic gold medalist for Brazilian volleyball," and like, when his talk finished, I was like, I can never be an Olympic gold medalist. Like, I'd have to be born again. You know what I mean? But with your story, I feel like I could do it. You know, anyone can do it. And that's what's cool about it. And I, like you met me, I'm no stronger than anyone else. I'm not more intelligent. I am not more courageous. That's for sure. I'm a very afraid, I want to say kid. I feel like I'm an eternal kid. I'm an old man now. But, you know, the only difference that I have from anyone else is that I wrote it down, took the first step, put you aside, planned and executed. That's it, which anyone can do.
I would beg to differ. You have a, an energy, like a vibrancy about you. Like, you know, we normally for you guys at home, normally when I record these podcasts, on the screen in front of us, we can see each other. And I was really looking forward to doing this with Philippe, because there's a light that shines out of you when you're passionate about stuff. And our internet connection wasn't good, so we turned the screens off just so that we can record the thing and not have any interruption. So I'm kind of missing that bit. But no, there is a, and I don't know if you've always had that, but you have this energy, this vibe, this, it's like there's a light shines out of you, an energy that comes out of you. And I don't know if that was normal for you, or that is just something that's happened along the way when you, okay, I guess when you find your purpose and you find your passion, that can come out of you.
Yeah, I think that, you know, looking at you is the same thing. I feel the same way looking at you and talking to you, you know what I mean? And I think that you just nailed it. It's that passion. It's that purpose. It's doing what we love. It's actually taking advantage of this this moment, this opportunity. Like, we tend to forget, like, the only thing we know, folks, everyone listening to me right now, is that this life has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That's the only thing we know. It's going to expire. Our ticket is going to expire. We don't know when and where, but it's going to end. And I meet so many people out there that are living with these masks and are living for other people and are not doing what they meant here to do. You know, they're not living a full, fulfilling, happy life. And so I think that when we do that, when we're able to, again, put that fear aside, I know it's really hard, and, you know, the butterflies, they're flapping, and people around you that you think are going to push you forward, pull you back. When you're able to just put that all aside and focus on what is it that I'm here for and what is my purpose, it's just, you know, it's all light. We're all energy. The energy we put out is the energy that comes at us. You know, that's proven fact. We're energy. And so I try to put the best energy out all the time.
You have an amazing energy and such an amazing story. So thank you so much for joining me on the podcast here. Can you give us all the details of how to find you and all your stuff? So, okay, let's go over the books. So there's two books so far.
Yep.
Long Ride Home and Long Ride to the End of the World. And where can people find those?
You can find those on Amazon.com or Amazon.ca.
Okay, Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. What about you on social media? You're on Instagram, I know.
Yep. So I'm on Instagram. I'm at Felipe Massetti. My name is spelled Filipe Massetti.
I got a question for you about Brazilians and their names. So
shoot.
Your name is Philip Massetti Leite.
No. My real name is Felipe Massetti de Souza Leite.
Very good. So what is it with the three names?
It's just ridiculous. What's the last name?
What's the last name?
There's no middle names. My name is Felipe. My last name is Massetti de Souza Leite. Because they just want to bring, like, oh, let's pull the last name from your great-great-grandfather who's been dead for 300 years to honor him. And then we'll put in the last name from your great-great-grandmother who never came to Brazil from Italy. So it's a mess. I have so many banking problems and traveling problems, as if it wasn't complicated enough, because my name is so long.
Okay, so they're kind of like a woman that gets married and keeps her maiden name and has the new one, but it's different. Because, like, exactly. Looking at all the Brazilian bull riders, they've all got a lot of names, and I wondered how all that works. Okay, that makes sense.
All last names.
Okay, so Instagram, Felipe Massetti. What about the movie? Does you got anything else you can tell people about the movie?
So I would like to invite everyone listening to this June 16th, 7 p.m. at the Chinese Theater's iconic downtown Hollywood, Los Angeles. We're going to start. We're going to have a little cocktail at 5 p.m. red carpet. It's going to be a real vibe there. I hope people that live in the area that are listening to this in California, please do come out. We need cowboy hats. We need cowboy boots. We need to celebrate the horse. You know, I know California is trying to ban rodeo, and this is the time to join together right now and show our power and how much we love these animals. So if you can come out, that would be the big one. And then we're going to be in Wyoming, Cheyenne, Wyoming. You can check out dates on my Instagram page at Felipe Massetti. Also going to be in Washington State and a few other festivals around the U.S. So you can check it out there.
Awesome. And I just texted my wife, and we're going to be in Australia on June 16th. So unfortunately, I cannot make that. That's something I would love to do. But
we'll figure it out. We'll get you to see it at some point.
We most certainly will. Well, once again, thanks so much for joining me on the Journey On podcast. If you guys at home, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.